time. Head down the 405. Gotta meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta work to feed the soul. But I can't do this all. Superman.
309 News Talk Radio, 580 CFRA, and hi, I'm Rob Snow, and welcome to the Healthiest Hour on Radio. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for the Wednesday House Call, and we're taking your health-related questions, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, and 1-800-580-CFRA. That's toll-free anywhere in North America. Encourage you, as always, to call early as the phone lines tend to fill up as we make our way through the hour. Great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Well, let's start with some news out of the United States. The health board there, the Food and Drug Administration, out with some comments today on what it calls a highly anticipated new drug to treat hepatitis C, saying it appears to cure more patients in less time than established drugs that have been in use for 20 years. So the FDA still has questions about how the drug should be combined with older medicines for maximum effect. I mean, we're talking about a serious liver disease here. What's your reaction to this news from the FDA today?
Well, this is good news because hepatitis C is one of those diseases that a lot of people don't know they have until they start to experience liver damage or liver failure. They get jaundice, nausea, anemias, fatigue, that kind of stuff. And we have to differentiate between hepatitis B and hepatitis C. Hepatitis C, different virus. Treatments today usually give about a 40% cure rate, lots of side effects with medications. But in this case, this new medication that is coming out, that they are reviewing, they're still looking at the data, still trying to determine what dose is effective, how right. long it needs to be used,
so
for which groups.
It's not approved or anything.
It's not approved yet. It's gone through its three phases of study
clinical
trials. And nevertheless, they are finding within about 6 months the viral load, that is the actual virus itself, is gone. Doesn't mean it can't come back. It means that the detectable levels are extremely low. So they've really stopped the virus in its tracks. And that's what's really interesting about this and exciting, because it does offer for a lot of people who may not have responded completely to the other medications that are available a means now to control their disease. And in fact, for some, and they're claiming about 60 to 65% cure rate when this is combined with the other medications. And that actually is terrific considering where we were before.
You have in the United States 3.2 million people who are suffering with the effects of having this virus, hepatitis C. And just to make it clear how long it actually takes to develop a new medication, we've talked about this before, the cost of research and development. This particular drug, which is being... and it's under review by the FDA right now from Merck, one of the biggest of big pharma, 15 years in development.
That's right.
This medication.
And it's still not approved.
It's still not there.
So
right?
If they decide that this is not good enough, then the drug doesn't go anywhere. So it's 15 years of research to do this and nothing happens with it. So hopefully they will see enough evidence to say this is reasonable to approve and it will be available to patients for treatment of hepatitis C.
And it would be used, according to the report on CTV News today, it would be used in combination with older drugs as a drug cocktail.
That's correct.
Why would they go that approach, do you think?
The reason is for the same reason when you treat HIV. You're using different medications to interfere with the process of how the virus survives, infects, and grows. And you interfere at each of those stages. So you have a much greater chance of arresting the virus from proceeding and causing damage, as opposed to depending on only one system to try and block. So it's attacking it from many sides. It's like a war. You have different fronts. You have different strategies to try and gain on your adversary. And you use all means available to try and stop that, as opposed to depending on one strategy alone.
Most people, as you mentioned, with hepatitis C do not know they have the virus until years after the occurrence. Symptoms include abdominal pain, fatigue, itching, and dark urine.
And it is also the one of the number one reasons to have a liver transplant. And so that is, so it's 12,000 liver transplants a year, I believe, 12,000 U.S. patients a year.
Yeah.
So in Canada, it's about 1,200 who need a liver transplant a year.
So interesting news there.
Yeah, and it's actually very enlightening news. You know, it's research, and it's they've made the effort to try and get something to work for a disease for which there was very little. There's no vaccine for hepatitis C, and that's what makes this so important. Unlike hepatitis B and hepatitis A, you can be vaccinated for those, and routinely now children are vaccinated for hepatitis B, but you can be vaccinated for that and enjoy lifelong immunity and never get the disease, whereas hepatitis C, there is no vaccine available for it.
How do you get it, hepatitis C?
Blood transfusions used to be for blood transfusions. A lot of it is
we had the whole Cleaver inquiry in Canada, a number of Hep C.
Yeah. They're sharing needles, and there's also your partner. Sometimes it's much more difficult to catch through that, but nevertheless,
it could be a sexually transmitted disease.
It can be, but the most common cause is usually sharing of needles or dirty needles.
Okay. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility. Or 1-800-580-CFRA if you have any health-related questions for Dr. Barry Dworkin. Every single phone line is available right now. So if you have any health-related questions, the wait will not be too long. I encourage you to call right now. So again, Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for the Wednesday House Call. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, or 1-800-580-CFRA. Shadi.
Hi, how are you, Dr.?
Good.
Fine, thanks.
I have a question regarding the reoccurrence of shingles.
Yes.
Is that possible that comes back, although when I was a kid I had chickenpox, and then within maybe a year ago I had the shingles. I heard that it's possible that comes back. Is it right or not?
Yes, you can have a reactivation of shingles. It's not just one occurrence. You can have it depending on when someone has the recurrence in their life. So, for example, there are reports of people, even children, having shingles. But say you get shingles at age 30 or 40, and then it goes away. 20, 25, 30 years later, it can certainly come back, or even sooner. It depends on how well the body is able to suppress the virus.
It's not that like your body gets immune against the virus?
It does. In fact, you're quite correct. When you get the chickenpox, you develop antibodies to that particular virus. What tends to happen over time is that in order to suppress the virus, in this case to suppress the virus that leads to shingles or reactivation of shingles, you need to have a certain level or certain number of antibodies in order to keep it suppressed. And for certain reasons, depends on what causes this, but when that antibody level decreases, and it decreases as we get older, it doesn't protect us as well anymore. And so it allows that virus to reassert itself. And then when the virus comes out again, it stimulates an immune response. Your antibodies go up again, suppresses the virus once more. But again, if another 10, 15, or 20 years passes, that antibody level can subside once more, and it can reactivate again. And so that's the reason why there is a vaccine for shingles that's now recommended. They just changed the indication, Rob. Instead of age 60, it's now age 50. That what it is it stimulates the body to produce more antibodies again. And so it gives you that boost so that it's continually suppresses that potential to reactivate shingles.
So that's what we should ask from our family doctor?
If you are 50 years of age or older, there is a vaccine available for shingles. And if you've had a definite history of chickenpox in the past, then you are at risk of developing shingles as you get older. And so getting the vaccine is certainly recommended. There is a specific indication for it. But right now, it's for people over the age of 50 that will benefit most for it.
Thank you very much, Dr.
You're very welcome.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
You're very welcome.
Every week we get a call.
I know. It's very common. You know, shingles is... Because think about it, Rob, how many people have had the chickenpox? Lots of people. You're going to see less chickenpox now because of the vaccinations for children. But that really only started, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So you have people in their 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, who all have had the chickenpox. So shingles is going to be, again, with aging population, is going to be an increasing problem.
Up next is Archie in Nepean. Go ahead, Archie.
Yes, I'm calling regards to bronchitis.
Yes.
If you feel you have a touch of bronchitis, I mean, I've read a bit about it on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Should I see a doctor?
Bronchitis is one of those terms that tends to be a catch-all term because there are different forms of bronchitis. There is acute bronchitis, which is usually caused by a virus. For people who do not smoke, it is very rare for them to develop any bacterial type of bronchitis. So a lot of the antibiotics that are given to people who are told they have bronchitis, especially if they are non-smokers, are likely taking the antibiotic for nothing because most of the time it is viral in origin.
I'm an ex-smoker.
Even if you're an ex-smoker, that still makes you now a non-smoker.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, getting an infection, especially where it's primarily a cough and not much else, without much of a fever, it's unlikely that an antibiotic is going to help in that situation. What commonly happens and what bronchitis tends to be mistaken for is actually something that we call bronchospasm. It's almost very similar to what asthmatics experience when they get sick, in that the airway, the large airways, the bronchi that head into the lungs, become irritated from the infection. It damages the lining of the walls of these structures. They become very twitchy and irritated. Any type of droplets or saliva or dust or any particulate matter that you breathe in can irritate it even further. The coughing is literally something you want to try and escape from. At night, you can't stop coughing. It feels like you're going to cough up half a lung sometimes.
Wow.
And the treatment for it, because people assume, and understandably so, they assume that all that coughing means that there is some significant bacterial infection or pneumonia or something that is causing this, but really it's physical damage to the tissue itself. And the healing time for that can take quite a bit of time.
Well, that's why I'm calling. It seems to go on.
It
marginally improves, but
it can go on for a long time. And a lot of times it has to do with the healing process. And also the coughing itself disrupts the tissue. It's traumatic to the tissue.
Mm-hmm.
The treatment for it is actually to use one of the things to use is an inhaler to calm down the airway,
mm-hmm.
to relax the muscles around the airway, but also to reduce the inflammation. It's the same medication that's used for people who have asthma, but in this case, it's specific for this problem.
Mm.
There are people who end up coughing, myself included, sometimes for 8 or 10 weeks after I get a viral infection, and I have to use the inhaler to control the coughing. There's no asthma per se, because I'm fine otherwise, but it is a very common thing, and bronchitis tends to be the tag that we put on it, but it's important to have a very specific diagnosis because, again, with a diagnosis means there's a specific treatment.
Should I be pursuing that?
I would. If you're still coughing and it's still bothering you, I think it's worthwhile. There's a few things you can do, too, in terms of testing.
Mm-hmm.
For someone that has a continual cough and they're having some difficulty, you can do what's known as a pulmonary function test. It's a test that measures how well you're able to breathe, your lungs are able to empty and fill, and it helps diagnose if there's anything blocking or causing the spasming.
Mm.
It'll show up on it. And also a simple test in the office with an inhaler to see if it calms down the cough.
Mm.
There are a few things that can be done. Chest x-ray is something that may be done if on physical exam they suspect something is going on in the lung. But otherwise, the first step would be always to go in to have those lungs listened to, and then likely do that pulmonary function test just to get the ball rolling on a particular direction.
Well, I seem to be improving one cough at a time.
That's how it goes.
Yeah. It's my first experience.
It's not pleasant. It's likely going to happen again, unfortunately, but that's especially during the winter months. It is something that it can drive you nuts. It really can.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Archie.
Good day.
Thank you, Archie. Good luck. We'll have to stop here, and then we'll get more of your phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin coming up right after the 3:30 news here on CFRA. All right, Dr. Dworkin is with us here. It's the Wednesday house call. I've had to keep him subdued, ladies and gentlemen. I've given him a little bit of Ritalin, and he's calmed down because, unfortunately, he lives in Riverside South. So he's not going to get to water the garden this summer because of this outdoor ban. And if I catch you out there with the hose, I'm calling bylaw on you. Big fines, $500 up to $100,000.
You do that, you better watch what you drink in your coffee.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-CFRA if you have any health-related questions for Dr. Barry Dworkin. That's why he's here every week, folks, to take your health-related questions and help you navigate this complex healthcare system that we have. And don't worry, though, once we get Prime Minister Jack, doctors will be falling from the sky. Betty.
Hi.
Hi, Betty. What's wrong?
Well, I've been living at a retirement home, and for about the last 2 months, it seems following every meal. Sometimes I get stomach cramps, but no matter whether or not, it seems I have an easy bowel movement. Mm-hmm. I don't drink any tea or coffee as a rule, and usually just a pot of hot water and occasionally the cranberry juice or V8 or tomato, mm-hmm. and I have soups.
Well, normally there is a reflex that's called a gastrocolic reflex. What this is for the most part, when you eat something, you want to your digestive system wants to prevent anything from backing up or getting constipated. So in other words, what happens when you eat, it causes the intestine to contract and push things forward. Things can change over time. The foods that we eat can influence bowel function. Certain diseases can influence bowel function. But usually, if it's when you're noticing it's only when you eat something that this happens, it's likely that reflex that is contributing to it. If this is happening outside of a meal, that is throughout the entire day, or you've noticed that your frequency of bowel movements has increased, then what I would suggest is that this should be evaluated to make sure that there's nothing going on within the intestine that is contributing to this increased frequency. So is this happening when you eat alone, or is this happening at other times as well?
Oh, sometimes I have an extra one, like in the afternoon mm-hmm. as well. So I should see my family doctor.
If it's something that you find has been suddenly different, if there's any blood, if you notice there's any blood when you go to the bathroom, that is there. But a lot of times it is just simply a change in frequency. It doesn't necessarily reflect any disease process. If you're not having any pain, if there's been no weight loss, if you're still able to eat the foods that you enjoy and not have any difficulty digesting those foods, there's probably not much to do. You could certainly see your family doctor if this is something that persists and causes dehydration or weight loss or diarrhea. But for the moment, if it's just when you eat something that this occurs, probably not much to do at the moment.
Yeah, and could this also be a result of aging as well? I've just turned 80.
Well, when you do get older, the bowel does change. What you might find helpful is as we get older, we tend to lose bacteria that help our digestion. And so there are different yogurts out there that have the probiotic bacteria. I'm not going to say that this is a magic cure for anything. There's no harm in doing this, though, because it is contributing bacteria that your intestine normally uses to help digest food. So there's no harm in doing this. But we do know that as people get older, they do tend to lose those bacteria and don't replace them as well. And so they don't tend to digest as well, and they can get all kinds of bloating and cramps and more gas and changes their bowel habits.
That's good because I like yogurt.
Yeah, so I would, any of the ones, there's no specific brand, any of the ones that have probiotic cultures in them is fine to try. And, you'll know within a month if that's helpful.
On to another call now. And John on line one. Go ahead, John. You're on with Dr. Dworkin.
Hello, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I'm calling about my daughter who I took to the airport on Friday to go to Punta Cana.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a crick in her neck when she was complaining about it. When she arrived, I guess the pain got much more severe.
Mm-hmm.
And went down her back, and she blacked out and fell, hit her nose and broke it, I believe. And so she went to the hospital, had an x-ray,
mm-hmm.
and they think it could be a pinched nerve in her neck. My question is, she's coming back mm-hmm. on Friday, and I wonder if she should go directly to the emergency or just go to a walk-in clinic, which that's what she's thinking. And I'm wondering if a pinched nerve in the neck can cause you to black out.
Usually it's sudden severe pain that can sometimes do that. It's just the shock of having that pain. A pinched nerve in the neck shouldn't make you black out. And the reason is that it's a nerve root that is coming out of the spinal cord. It's not the spinal cord itself that is being damaged. And so you can't, there's no connection with that if you squeeze on that nerve to somehow cause someone to black out. It's the severe pain can do that. But also, I would still question whether it's a pinched nerve. X-rays are not the greatest in terms of determining whether there's a pinched nerve or not. You really can't see the nerves mm-hmm. on an X-ray. And if the pain is going down her neck, that is down her back.
Down her back, and she's getting she has a tingling in her arm?
Yeah, you'd still have to determine, again, a nerve will go usually radially outwards. It doesn't go down. It will provide sensation sort of to the side. So if it's coming out at one level of her neck, it'll affect only that level, certain level of the body. It won't go downwards. So again, she needs to have a physical exam done. I wouldn't go to the eMERGE. There's no reason for that. I would have this evaluated first. It can very easily be assessed in a drop-in clinic or if she has a physician that she sees instead of waiting in the eMERGE for 8 hours. It's something that can be very easily handled on the outside of the eMERGE.
Okay. I get worried when people black out.
It happened
brain
once. Unlikely. It also was after a flight. She was seated in a plane for a while. There's a whole host of things that can contribute to blacking out, especially the fact that she had this sudden pain. So, and she hasn't had that since. So it's unlikely to be brain related.
Sean on line three, you're up next with Dr. Dworkin. Go ahead.
Hello. I had ACL surgery in January.
Yeah.
And I've been going through physio. And this past week, my physiotherapist thinks that my ACL has detached because there's too much slack in my knee now.
Mm-hmm.
And they had taken some of my hamstring to repair my ACL.
Right.
On that leg. So where do we go from here if it is?
If they suspect that the ACL has ruptured within the knee, then the next step would be follow up with the orthopedic surgeon. And if that's not possible right away, then the other step would be to do an MRI of the knee again to see if the ligament itself is detached. That's the only way to really know. A physical exam can tell you because you can sometimes get what's known as a drawer sign. That is when you hold the knee from above and below, hold the leg, and you can move the knee backwards and forwards, sort of like pulling a drawer out of a dresser. That's an indication that the ligament is damaged, but it's not definitive. It's certainly suggestive, but ideally to know
how
much damage.
Would he be in pain if that happened? Wouldn't there be pain?
Not necessarily. No? Not necessarily, but nevertheless, the next step would be an imaging study to actually see if that indeed has happened.
See, they did do that test where she kind of sat on my foot and she said there was way too much slack.
It might be, but in order to have confirmation, I would have the orthopedic surgeon see you.
Yeah.
And then as well, they may want to do an MRI afterwards in order to evaluate the knee, but they'll be able to tell you pretty clearly if that indeed happened.
This will be the last call. It's Gabrielle. Go ahead.
Hi. I had an aneurysm, was operated for an aneurysm, cerebral aneurysm, mm-hmm. back in 1996.
Yeah.
And now I'm getting headaches, and it seems it's the same headaches I used to get back then before it happened.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, should I get checked out? And if so, like, can they check that out?
I would absolutely go check that out if it's the headaches that you remembered having when you had the aneurysm. Absolutely. I wouldn't even hesitate to do that. You know, the worst that comes out of this is they say it's just regular headaches after they do the evaluation. But really, you don't want to have this hanging over you and wondering whether it is or isn't, given that
What kind of tests do they do to determine that?
Usually they do CT scans in order to look for aneurysms. And they use a dye along with the CT in order to look. They do an arteriogram of the skull.
Drink the dye or
no? It's intravenous. Injected? It's okay. Intravenous, yeah. And they will look to see if there's any aneurysm there. But again, she's having headaches. She's already had surgery for an aneurysm. Yeah.
They don't mess around with that, by the way.
You don't mess around with that. You have to go check that out.
Just in my own family history, some relative who had an aneurysm before, and boom.
Yeah. You're having headaches.
If you have that history, right?
And if you haven't had headaches for, and all of a sudden you're getting headaches and you have a history of that, you got to go get that checked out. Absolutely.
You're on again this weekend?
For another two-hour stint.
On Sunday?
From 4 to 6.
Day before the federal election.
Day before the election.
So maybe a little health policy thrown in for good measure.
Maybe we'll do that again.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Wednesday's always a treat to have you in here, Dr. Barry Dworkin, and the Wednesday House Call. Don't forget health headlines as well at around 10 to 7 during Madeley in the Morning.